ignored most all of the people in the club except for me and the bartender, and, of course, you when you were dancing, I said. He saw me dance, she asked, suddenly shy like a middle schooler. She's almost 23, the deadliest fighter I know, with killer business instincts. But in some ways, she is still a child. I'll say. Knocked him for a loop, but then he started looking for the hell thingy, almost frantic to find it. Remember, he said he had a vision about you? She blurred across the room. Damn, that girl can move. She was back on the exam table holding a certain piece of paper with a familiar picture on it. Doc Singh had apparently not seen it, and she handed it right over. Then a new frown appeared. He shouldn't have done that, she said. Done what, dear heart? Galina asked. When he pulled out the second dart, a piece broke off inside my chest. I pounced on him and drank from him, and he reached in and pulled out the piece, she said, pointing at a table in the corner where I could see a silver knife and dart and a small piece of silver. I was preying upon him, and he helped me. Why would he do that? She asked. He likes you, Nika said. And to answer your earlier question, he has no girl in his life, or even close friends. Tanya didn't say anything, but instead just looked down at her lap, her hands smoothing her sweats on her legs. So what's the story with him? I asked Nika. Everybody in the room turned to look at our family telepath. Christian Gordon, rookie cop. As you say, he grew up way, way upstate. Something tragic happened to his family many years ago. It involved one of those demons. He's the only survivor. He had a few flashbacks, especially when Arkady got in his face. He was telling the truth. He's been hunting demons his whole life, and basically exorcises them by willpower or something. Something supernatural. It's incredibly dangerous, as we saw by Tanya's near call, she said. Why was he so nonchalant about us? Galina asked. He doesn't expect to live very long. He's also sad, tired, and lonely, and has been dealing with hell since he was a child. He understood our advantages, but he was already invested in Tanya's survival. He thought we would kill him. I think he almost welcomed it, she said. I snuck a peek at Tanya. Blue eyes as big as quarters soaked up every detail of the story with utter and complete fascination. She blinked at the last part and turned those eyes on the rest of us. We won't kill him, Tanya said. It wasn't a question, more like a statement of fact, or maybe a command. Her first ever, actually, her second. Did you tell Sanka all that? I asked Nika, pointedly not looking at Galina and ignoring Tanya's words. I caught a frown in my peripheral vision from Mama Fang. Not yet. Galina and Tanya spoke to her. She's freeing up her schedule to get here before Tanya's birthday bash, if at all possible, Nika said. Nika and I work together, and we really only answer to Elder Sanka, but Galina continually tries to bring us both to heel. I will inform Mother of the details, Galina said right on cue. Of course, I said. He said he would be back, Tanya said. Tomorrow, to look for the demon. We'll have to see what he does, dear heart. He's only human, she said. Oh, that's the direction? Wrong choice, Mama, wrong choice. She really hadn't figured it out, or was attempting to ignore the facts in hope that they would go away. Her little girl, who was also the basis of her personal power, had changed drastically in the course of 5 minutes, and those changes were still coming. Decades ago, as a young girl, I traveled by train with my family out west on a winter trip. As we passed through the Rockies, the conductor pointed out an avalanche sliding down the side of one vast peak, not overly far from our tracks. He turned to me with a wink and said, "Little lady, if you ever find yourself caught in an avalanche, don't try to fight it. It will crush you. Instead, try to float on it or sort of swim with it." We were in the beginnings of an avalanche, and Mama was fighting it. Nika and I were going to sail a boat over the top of this one. My blonde friend caught my eye and winked. Well, Tanya, Lydia reports the police officer is okay and the good doctor has pronounced you fit. Perhaps it is time you settled in for the day, hmm? Galina suggested. Okay, Tanya said, back to looking demure. She agreed much, much too quickly. Galina eyed her for a moment, but she was the very essence of innocence when she looked up at her mother. Come on, T, let's go settle in. I'll do your nails while Nika tells us about your personal cop, I said, smiling at Tanya without a glance Galina's way. I grabbed Tanya's hand and pulled her toward her quarters, catching Nika's eye. The three of us took off, leaving a frowning Galina behind. Tanya has a huge room on the second floor, with its own private patio garden on the top of the conservatory space. It's basically my second bedroom, mine and Nika's. We've spent many, many days with Tanya. Not all, but many. Vampires are at least as social as humans, usually more so, although how we socialize is maybe different from the stock species. Touch and contact are often part and parcel of our connections. Once inside, we changed into sleepwear and I broke out the nail care supplies. Tanya sat cross-legged, her left hand draped on my knee while I removed her old polish. Our nails extend when we fight, becoming true claws. And it's hell on manicures. Hers were cracked and flaking. So, Nika? Tanya asked. Nika lifted her head, ready to speak, but I held up a hand. Nope, not yet. First, you maybe want to tell us what you're feeling? I asked. She looked reluctant. Tanya, you're speaking again. Hello, 15 years? She met my gaze, then looked away.
He saved me. Then I attacked him, and he saved me again. I think he touched my heart, she said.
I smirked, and her eyes narrowed.
No, Lydia, I mean it. He literally touched my heart when he took out that piece of silver. It was like a big shock.
Wait, you're saying he reached into your open wound and literally touched your heart? I asked.
He reached in and grabbed the shard of silver. I think one of his fingers brushed my actual heart. I felt a shock. I think he did too, she said.
What happened after that? I asked.
It stopped me from feeding on him. Probably just in time, she said, eyes going off to the side.
Maybe, maybe not, but you stopped. That was your decision. He could have punched you in the head and you could have just ignored it. You needed blood. I saw what was on the floor. You yourself lost more blood than most Darkin could and still function. And you only took a portion of his, nowhere near what you lost, I said.
But I'm fine, Lydia. Better than fine, she said.
Exactly my point, my dear, I said, deciding to change topics. So how did it taste? Your first live blood in 15 years? Her eyes got wide.
Like no other blood I've ever had, live or bagged.
Well, it has been a while, Nika said.
No, Nika, I've had blood so newly donated that the donor was still being bandaged when I drank it. People have brought me flavors of blood from all over the world. Nothing tasted like his, she said, frowning.
So your boy toy has super blood? I said, picking through the reds in her collection of fingernail polish. Cliché, yes, but it seemed right. I picked a deep red.
He's not my boy toy, she protested, suddenly crestfallen. He doesn't even like me.
I looked at Nika, giving her a little head tilt, while taking Tanya's hand in mine.
Oh, but he does, dear one. That's why he was so mad and hurt when you called him a liar,
the blonde telepath said.
He's mad at me? Tanya said.
Well, he was when he left, which is why I know he likes you. You wouldn't get that level of emotional response if he didn't care about your opinion, Nika said.
But now he's mad,
she protested, looking down at the deep blood red I was painting onto the nails of her left hand.
He'll get over it, I said with a shrug.
He'll remember how hot you looked and forget all about his anger.
That's actually really true. Men are simple visual creatures, Tanya. They are easily overwhelmed by good looks, Nika said.
Well, he's pretty good looking too, don't you think?
Our vampire princess asked.
He is, And he has amazing eyes, I agreed, watching carefully.
I know, right?
She exclaimed. Her hand twitched, just a small tremor, really. On Tanya, that was the equivalent of a regular person jerking their hand right out of mine. Someone was pretty hyped up.
So you think he'll come back to, hunt that demon thing? The Hellborn?
He strikes me as a young man of his word. I would expect him to follow through with his intent to protect you, I said.
Nika nodded. He went away mad but still determined to hunt the thing, she said. And it's very dangerous. I never even saw that thing till it had already shot me,
Tanya said. I don't think they can sneak up on him, Tanya. He tracked that thing like a bloodhound right through the club, and he's done this many times. He's probably no more in danger from this demon than from our own security guys, I said. Her head snapped up, staring into my eyes. Then she was gone, the door left swinging open as the wind of her passage left lilac and jasmine notes hanging in the air. We tracked her down, moving to keep up. Found her on the main floor, standing in front of a startled Vadim and Arkady.
And you will tell Mr. Deckard not to hurt him if he shows up here?
She was asking. Actually, it seemed more like a demand.
Yes, Tanya, I will convey that message to Deckard when he comes on shift,
the big vampire said, him in his snakeskin vest staring down at the compact beauty in white and pink footy pajamas.
Although he doesn't likely know where we live.
He'll find us. He is very resourceful,
Nika said. Vadim nodded at her words, but Arkady just stared at her. Nika and I wore more abbreviated sleepwear than Tanya, and everyone in Demidova Central knew Arkady had a bit of a thing for our telepath. Satisfied? I asked. Tanya held Vadim's eyes for a moment, then turned to me and nodded. Nika grabbed her hand and led her away. I waited till they were on the staircase, talking about what Nika had meant about the cop's resourcefulness. A word of caution. Make sure the day crew understands how important that cop's health is. I think it is safe to say it is literally a matter of life and death. Theirs. And you? I said, turning to Arkady. Don't even glare in that particular human's direction.
You can't think she has chosen?
Vadim asked. I can, and I do. Upstairs, we got our excited princess calmed, talking about boys and kissing and boys, as the sky outside began to lighten. The automatic shades slid down over the windows, and gradually the three of us succumbed to the pressure of the new day, falling into our normal deep slumber. Sudden movement brought me awake all at once. Tanya was sitting upright in her massive king bed, and then she was gone. Again. Outside, night was falling. It took me longer to track her through the house, but her angry voice was as clear as a bell. She was in the back of the ground floor, standing in the door of the security office. She had a hand on each side of the doorframe, her nails extended and driven deep into the splintering wood.
Who hurt him?
She hissed at Deckard. I smelled urine as I got closer. And fear. Lots of good old human fear. There were five heavily armed, highly trained ex-special ops types in that office, and they were all smart enough to realize that their immediate death was standing in the doorway. What happened? I asked, loud enough to at least get the daytime security chief's attention. Deckard was a retired Marine. Never say ex-Marine, trust me. Like all the other human security staff, he was battle-hardened and highly experienced. But Deckard took the whole confident, unruffled thing to lofty new levels for a human. We liked to joke that Tanya was the only born vampire, but Deckard was born with the mind of one. He was sweating.
The individual that Security Chief Vadim warned us about, Officer Chris Gordon, entered the rear compound over the wall and apprehended an individual we failed to detect, despite Vadim's warning and description. He then proceeded to conduct some form of arcane exorcism ritual, and the other intruder was left dead. During his altercation with the intruder, Officer Gordon scraped his cheek on the stone of the patio. To our knowledge, that is the only wound he sustained,
Deckard said, eyes alternating between me and Tanya. The other four had moved their eyes to me, refusing to risk looking at the angry death angel in front of me. Oh, and it bled a little, right? The cheek? I asked, understanding blooming in my head.
Just a little. He did not require any first aid and would not stay. He said he had to help a child with a problem tonight. A demonic problem,
Deckard said. I put my hand on Tanya's arm, feeling the steel hardness of it relax to merely oak density.
He is all right?
She asked, her voice much, much less harsh than seconds before.
He bounced right up in front of all my guys like he was ready to take us all on. Then Sykes brought Apollo out and the damn dog just lay down on this cop's feet like a lap dog. Wagged his damn tail,
Deckard said. Apollo likes him? Tanya asked. By now the guys had shifted from fear of her to astonishment at her speech. Of course the dog liked him. He's like a damned guard dog himself. All purple puppy dog eyes, I said. Tanya giggled, just a little. Lydia, you're being facetious, she protested, yet she was smiling at my words. Deckard's eyes widened at the abrupt change in our princess, but he wisely kept his mouth shut.
So he's helping out the child? Tanya asked him.
He got a text while I was talking to him. He didn't like it. I told him he needed to be here for when Galena woke up, but he refused. Said he had to leave, but that you all could likely track him down if you needed to,
Deckard said. What was your impression, Mr. Deckard? I asked.
Kid has ball, guts. He scrambled over our wall way too easy, and he's got good ground fighting skills. Ran a background check. He comes up spotless. First name is actually Christian. Got very high marks in the police academy. Also, he's not easily intimidated, ma'am.
No, Mr. Deckard, he's not, I said. He fought well? Tanya asked.
I have the footage here, ma'am, if you like,
one of the other security guys suggested, pointing at the CCTV system.
Oh, yes, I would like that very much, Tanya said. Then she turned to Deckard. I am sorry I was so abrupt with you and your men, Mr. Deckard. I smelled his blood and thought he'd been harmed, she said.
Well, we were very careful to follow Vadim's instructions regarding Officer Gordon, ma'am,
Deckard said, clearly confused but adapting. Tanya nodded, then turned to the one guard who had pissed himself, his khaki pants wet down the inside of both legs.
I am sorry to frighten you, Samuel. I will buy you new pants. Maybe in black or navy blue this time?
She asked, eyebrows raised. Was that a joke? The guy by the monitors snorted.
You might need to get those for all of us, ma'am. I wasn't far behind Sam myself. Here's the footage, he said.
My suddenly talkative ward moved smoothly over to the bank of monitors, the men hastily making space for the girl in footy pajamas. Deckard waited till she was engrossed in the action, then turned to me with raised eyebrows. Mr. Gordon saved Tanya from that demon last night. She was grossly wounded and fed from him. He promised her he would come back today and see if he could catch that thing, I explained. As you've noticed, she's decided to talk to us again. Tanya sniffed.
Well, of course I had to talk. I had to speak to Christian,
she said, not looking away from the monitor.
Oh, that's some kind of modified armbar,
she said, hands darting to the keyboard to back up the footage and roll it again.
The thing didn't seem to feel pain, ma'am. He was obviously trying to be real fast. Then he held up his arm and that bird thing came and it was all over.
Another guard, Benson, said.
Bird thing?
Tanya asked.
Something supernatural. It just kind of popped in, grabbed something from his hand, then popped out. Huge. As big as a hang glider,
Benson said, pointing to the screen. I found I had moved myself closer to see, and the images defied logic. Tanya turned to me, eyes wide.
Lydia, do you think that was an angel?
Seemed like a really big, smoky eagle or hawk, Miss Tanya. There was this kind of sound, like a note on a bell or a crystal or something, but it didn't strike me as angelic. Not that I'd be a good judge,
Benson said.
Benson was there when it happened,
Deckard explained. Tanya turned to me but didn't speak. She didn't need to. Yes, we will track him down. Somehow, I said. The guys were all exchanging glances, but none of them dared comment.
Good.
I want to see him, she said, her tone brooking no argument.
Why did I suddenly think we were all going to be seeing him a lot? 15 years of silence and it all changed in one night, in less than 5 minutes. She was like a whole different person, like she had grown in years over the course of hours. Demon hunter or cop or whatever, there was way more to this guy than anyone knew. But deep down in my gut, I did know that whatever we found out in the days ahead, it was gonna be huge.
Growing pains. Raising teenagers is hard work, but what if your kid was touched by God? Alex Gordon pulled into his farmhouse driveway and shut off the engine of his F-150. As he stepped out, his left foot went into a puddle of spring melt, almost up to the very bottom of the laces. Quickly yanking it clear, he waited for any sign of icy wetness inside his sock, but the snow seal waterproofing he worked into all his boots held firm. He stamped his feet hard on the slab of sandstone just before the little porch, wiped his boots on the welcome mat, then again on the old floor rug just inside the door. The mudroom entry was a shambles of boots, sneakers, and haphazardly hung jackets. He paused and listened to the old house. A slight hiss and rhythmic metallic thudding brought him into the kitchen to the Fisher wood stove, whose door was just slightly ajar and swinging as the well-fed fire inside drew air in steady gusts. Kid fed the stove when he got home, then left the door open to get the fire up to heat. Alex latched the stove door shut. A glance at the counter showed lidless jars of peanut butter and Smucker's grape jelly, a purple-coated table knife laying across the mouth of the jelly jar. The bread loaf bag had been closed and wire-tied, but none of the sandwich fixings had made it back to their rightful places in the old farm kitchen. Alex moved slowly into the living room, immediately spotting a crumb-strewn plate on the coffee table, next to a familiar book bag. An empty glass with a coating of milk at the bottom stood next to the plate. No kid, though. Again, he paused and listened. Silence, then suddenly a dull thwack coming from the bathroom, or else just outside the bathroom. He moved into the little half-bath off the family room and looked out the window at the side yard. A kid. Mid-teens, jeans and Timberland work boots, worn t-shirt selling the virtues of Maddox feed and stock. The shirt had either shrunk over countless washings, or else the kid had grown again, because the well-worn cotton clung to a tightly muscled torso that flexed as it powered a heavy splitting maul up and over broad shoulders, then down into a big chunk of sugar maple. That's right. Len had mentioned that he was going to drop the ancient maple on the side of the house before it could drop on the house. Len had bucked it up into big 3-foot diameter rounds, and now the kid was going to town on it. Spring in northern New York was still pretty cool, but the air steamed around the 15-year-old, and a good-sized pile of split maple indicated that he'd been working hard for a while. Reading signs was a habit trained into Alex Gordon first by his father, then by the Corps, reinforced by the North Korean Army, and honed by decades living on an active farm. Whether you were tracking a sheep-killing coyote through St. Lawrence County Forest, an enemy soldier through foreign lands, or an upset teen through a farmhouse, sign was sign. It was interpreting it that counted. Outside the window, Alex's grandson, Christian Gordon, moved around the knotty 2-foot hank of maple that had started out being a full foot wider in diameter. Close-cut, almost military-length brown hair framed a tanned face that looked boy next door until the kid lifted his head to reveal eyes a shade of violet rarely found in the human iris. A deep, angry frown and narrowed gaze lasered the troublesome round of wood that was clearly putting up a hell of a fight. Multiple blade marks on the top of the wood indicated that Chris had found himself a knotted nightmare, but the kid wasn't letting it go. Taking a step back, Chris wound the maul back up behind him and slammed it down in a hard arc that would have rung the bell on any carnival strongman high striker game in the state. It only succeeded in wedging the maul into the top of the log. Clearly undeterred, Chris stepped forward, bent at the knees, grabbed the maul handle tight up near the head,
and powered both the axe and attached log up behind his right shoulder. He took a step to the right, lined up with another yet untouched round of heavy old wood that he was using as a chopping block, and brought the axe and log over his shoulder, upside down so that the back of the head hit the block first, momentum driving the log down further onto the blade. It was a technique that Alex had taught Chris himself, and it was usually just the medicine for a reluctant log. Sometimes, though, the log was just too gnarled. The maul was now buried almost to the top of its head in the tough wood, and Chris pulled the whole thing back, swinging the 40 or 50-pound bundle up over his shoulder and slamming it down again. Alex could see the maul was now truly jammed deep in the unyielding maple, and the kid was huffing and puffing with the effort, face twisted in disbelief and anger.
Shit,
Alex muttered, hurrying out of the bathroom, back through the living room and kitchen and out the back door. Jumping straight into a mammoth splitting log after just a quick snack wasn't Chris, unless he was mad or upset, or both. Now he was frustrated on top of all that, and Alex knew he had to hurry if he was going to save the handle of his good splitting maul.
Hold up a sec, Chris. Let me grab some wedges and a sledge. We'll double-team that SOB.
Chris looked at him, clearly and completely annoyed with everything, then swung the knotted mess back up.
No, son, you'll...
was as far as Alex got before the axe came down. Tired from the two previous heavy-duty swings, on top of a half-hour of splitting, Chris missed hitting the block in the center. Instead, he hit too far forward, the handle of the maul connecting with the sharp edge of the block, snapping with a loud, clear crack. I'll replace it, Chris said after staring at the broken maul for 3 full seconds.
Yes, you will. You'll get the wedge and sledge and get the head free. Then you'll put a new handle on it,
Alex said evenly.
You'll also pick up your mess in the house.
I was always going to do that, Chris said with a grimace.
But you're not doing any of it right now,
Alex said, his tone more than his words catching Chris's attention.
What am I doing instead?
Chris asked, frowning.
You're taking a trip with me. We gotta check out a place south of Newcomb. Desperius, tiny eye-blink of a town in the mountains,
Alex said, gesturing toward the house.
What's up with Desperius, which sounds like desperate? Chris asked.
It is desperate. Little town on the upper Hudson River, old garnet mining community, pretty economically desolate now. I got a call from a guy I know. Seems the place has gotten really hinky lately.
Like what?
Chris asked, broken maul handle dangling forgotten in his hand.
My friend has lived near there for years. Place was always a bit run down. Now, though, it's got a real nasty vibe to it. He hunts all around there, says the woods around the town are empty of animals, says the people he knows there have all gotten mean and very strange. Also, his daughter is sensitive. She won't go through the town, even in a car. Says evil lives there.
So when we going? Chris asked, dropping the handle.
Now, 2 fly fishermen just disappeared in the area. Got that from my same friend who runs the regional ranger office in Warrensburg.
Just like that, the annoyed, angst-filled teen was gone, and the young man that Alex secretly and only to himself called God's soldier was staring at him with violet eyes. Turning toward the house, Chris trotted toward the back door.
I'll grab some fetishes in my go-bag, Gramps. Meet you at the truck.
Alex followed his grandson at a brisk walk, leaving the extra hustle to the youth. Entering his bedroom, Alex pulled his own go-bag from the closet and double-checked that the water bottles in the side pocket were full. Then he went to his bedside table and fetched his Wilson Custom Combat 45 and cleared its chamber. Normal carry was chamber hot, safety locked. Carrying in demon country was the exact opposite. His right leg still bore the scar when a demonic entity clicked off his safety and tripped the seer, sending a big hollow point along the outside of his thigh, all from a holstered gun. Luckily, the pistol had jammed in the holster or the follow-up rounds would have been much worse. Belting the gun on, he added 2 double magazine belt carriers on his left side, then pulled his Carhartt work jacket over the whole kit and caboodle. A quick double-check assured him that his mountain lion fetish was hanging around his neck, which was way more important than the gun. Grabbing the go-pack, he headed for the door, meeting his foreman, Len, who was on his way in.
Need any backup?
Len asked after a quick glance at the pack.
I'm thinking no, but don't be too far from the phone just in case we need to call for the cavalry.
Air cav, maybe, Len said with a grunt. He's already in the truck, game face on, he added, thumbing back over his shoulder.
I think he came home bothered by something, but he tucks it away when duty calls.
Kid would make a hell of a Marine, Len said for maybe the 1,000th time.
Clapping his old second-in-command on the shoulder, Alex headed out to the truck. They were 30 minutes into the drive, almost halfway to Tupper Lake and already inside the Adirondack Park, before Alex took a stab at the elephant in the truck.
So, want to talk about it?
Chris turned from looking out his window, eyebrows up for just a split second, before he figured out the question's context. He turned to look straight ahead, shoulders slumping a bit. Alex waited, knowing things would either come at their own pace or not come at all. It was almost a full minute before the silence broke.
That dickwad Craig Schnell is going out on Lisa Gayette. She doesn't have a clue.
15 years old is the time when most boys are really beginning to pay attention to the opposite sex, even demon-hunting, heaven-favored boys. Maybe especially those, although Alex only knew of one.
Do any of her girlfriends know?
Alex asked, racking his brain to remember more about this Lisa other than her name had come up before. Chris didn't have friends, especially girls, much too great a danger to the individual, too big a draw for Hell's Hunters here on Earth. But he could admire from afar.
Who knows? It's some girl from Parrishville, I think. Saw them in his car out behind the bus maintenance building. Mr. Harris sent me out to get some new weight plates that got dropped off there.
Chris spent an hour in the school's weight room almost every afternoon, an arrangement that Alex had made with the school's football and strength training coach.
How do you know she's from Parrishville?
Alex asked. Chris didn't socialize with his own schoolmates, so how did he recognize a girl from another school?
I'm pretty sure she's a football cheerleader.
Football was Chris's only sport, and he only played it to build his speed, reflexes, and ability to tackle. The other coaches were always pressuring the kid to try additional sports, but other than a short experiment with wrestling, football was it. Some of his volunteer trainers could provide way more grappling arts training, but there was nothing like tackling a bigger, stronger runner to hone his skills in that department. But he really had to be paying attention to girls if he remembered a specific cheerleader.
So you're the only one who knows?
Alex asked. He got a nod in response.
Can't really tell anyone because you don't hang with them and they wouldn't trust you, right?
He asked, sort of talking it through out loud. Another nod.
Okay, I'll take care of it,
Alex said, carefully keeping his eyes on the road. In his peripheral vision, he saw Chris snap around to look at him.
What?
The tone was clear disbelief.
I said I'll take care of it.
But why? How? Gramps, what are you talking about?
Chris sputtered.
You can't intervene, can't show favorites, can't make friends. Lisa is someone you think well of, so I'll take care of it,
Alex said, enjoying himself immensely.
What would you even do?
Just a word here or there,
he said, going for mysterious. Chris was quiet for a moment or two.
Oh, you'll mention it to the guys and they'll pull him over, maybe with Lisa in the car, maybe with the other one? Drop a comment or something?
He said, working it through. The guys were a handful of St. Lawrence County deputy sheriffs, some of the only people clued in about his grandson.
Damn, that kid was quick.
Something like that,
Alex admitted, still hoping to retain some of the mystery of being Chris's problem solver. When he was honest with himself, Alex could admit that he loved being a grandfather more than anything else in his life. First the military, then work, either as a dairy farmer or during the period he had run the farm supply company, had taken massive amounts of his life, leaving him with far fewer memories of his family than he should have. If he could do it over, he never would have traded work for family life. His only son had grown up and left in the blink of an eye,
starting a family of his own. Then suddenly they too were gone. Only Chris had survived. Being Gramps to God's chosen soldier was a gift he refused to squander. The farm was still a work-intensive bastard, but with Len and his farmhands, it pretty much ran itself. Times like this, missions of good versus evil with his grandson, were what he lived for. Because, soon enough, this too would be gone. "Thanks, Gramps," Chris said, turning to look at him. "No problem," he said, poker-faced. Inside, he rejoiced at the confidence Chris had in him. "So what's up with these fishermen?" Chris asked a minute later. School drama solved, at least for now, they got down to shop talk.
"Couple of guys are from the city. They've been here before on guided float trips out of North Creek. This time they went on their own. Never showed up downstream. The Encon guys out of Warrensburg put out a call for people to help with the search and rescue starting at first light."
Alex Gordon was well known across the northern part of New York State as a search and rescue resource. Success at hunting enemy soldiers as the leader of a Marine Raider platoon in Korea had translated to being highly successful at hunting lost hunters, hikers, and tourists in the vast Adirondack Park. "Let me guess, their float trip should have taken them through Desperius," Chris asked.
"Correct. But Sean Sears, the local DEC guy, says that the locals weren't really helpful, or even attempting to be helpful,"
Alex said. Chris didn't respond. He glanced at his grandson. The boy was frozen, eyes wide, mouth open, staring straight ahead. Alex immediately pulled the truck over to the shoulder of the road.
"Chris? Chris?" he asked, shaking the boy.
It took two shakes before the eyes blinked and the mouth shut.
"Shit,"
Chris said, blinking at his gramps, who ignored the bad language. Then the boy was rummaging in the glove compartment, pulling out an old receipt for an oil change. Further scrabbles in the glove box produced a pencil, and then the kid was drawing, sketching like a man possessed.
"What are you doing? What happened to you?"
Alex asked, baffled.
"I don't know. It was a vision. I saw the fishermen, saw them tied up," Chris said, staring with slightly wild eyes into Alex's.
Somehow the pencil kept going, almost by itself. They both looked down at the picture, which Alex was amazed to see was really, really good. He looked back up and met Chris's own astonished gaze.
"I don't think it's even me," the kid said.
They both looked back down, ready at last to focus on the picture's details. Two men, bound back to back and slung upside down by their ankles, suspended over what looked like a cast iron pot. They wore recognizable fishing vests, a few feathered lures visible. Figures in robes and cowls surrounded them, a ridiculously large knife in one male figure's hand. Overhead, a round ball appeared to cast light through what had to be a stained glass window made colorless by the white paper and pencil.
"It's a full moon tonight," Chris said, pointing out the windshield on the other side of his gramps at the yellow orb hanging just over the eastern tree line.
"But this moon is really high, based on the angle,"
Alex said, taking the picture and turning it.
"I don't think this has happened yet," Chris said. "At least that's the feeling I have."
"And I know where this is," Alex said. "Sean described some of the town to me. There's an abandoned church that someone may be living in. That looks an awful lot like a stained glass window to me."
"How do we find the church?"
"Sean said you can't miss it, right on the main road through town,"
Alex replied, putting the truck back in gear and easing back out onto the road.
"Gotta get there in time."
"I think we will,"
his grandson said, a strange confidence in his voice. 12 minutes later, they crested a hill, spying the lights of Tupper Lake below them. 25 minutes after that, they were in Long Lake, turning left on Route 28 South, the Roosevelt-Marcy Trail that Teddy Roosevelt took in the middle of a September night in 1901, when President McKinley died from complications of a gunshot wound. Another 48 miles, and they spotted the tiny sign for Desperius. Slowing the Ford, Alex kept his eyes forward as he spoke.
"So, just like we discussed, we'll drive by the church building, then find a place to park and sneak back. Recon the situation, and then I'll call my ranger contact on my cell phone. Got it?"
Alex asked, holding up the Motorola flip phone he had let Chris talk him into buying. Chris reached over and took the phone, opening the lid and looking at the display.
Ah, Gramps, no signal. Probably no cell tower out this way, Chris said.
Shit, Alex said. The plan has already met its maker.
So we need to scout a landline while we're looking things over. Call your buddy from that phone, then see about getting these guys free,
Chris said, tapping the useless cell phone against the drawing on his lap.
Remember, you deal with the demon, I got the rank and file,
Alex said, adrenaline making his hands shake a little. A small, whitish, ill-kept church appeared on their left, and Alex slowed even further. Tiny and badly in need of paint, the House of God-shaped building felt entirely wrong to Alex, like it was befouled. Chris studied it intently, and Alex snuck as many looks at it as he could without crashing the pickup. Then the little building was gone, and they were around a bend in the road. Alex drove another quarter mile past several houses and a couple shack-like hovels that he suspected were also houses before finding a road that connected onto the route they were on. He made the side turn and parked the pickup, showed Chris where he was hiding the keys, then finally double-checked his holstered .45. Chris hopped out first and looked around at the moonlit forest that pressed in on them from both sides. The land rose and fell sharply. The road they had come in on twisting to match its rugged contours. Exchanging nods, they turned and trudged along the side of the main road, back toward the church. The first house they passed didn't appear to have any telephone wires coming off the overhead line, but the next one up did. That one had the soft glow of a light coming from one dirty window. Alex scouted around the property, posting Chris in the shadow of a small cedar tree while he studied the place. No dog dishes, run lines, or other signs of canine habitation, which was good. The house was a dump, but the wood piles were neat and orderly, comprising perhaps four full cords, he thought. Moving up to a window, he eased up until his right eye just peeked through the lower corner. Nothing. A jumbled living area, old recliner draped with a blue blanket, television dark on its stand, single lamp on an end table dimly lighting the place. Through a doorway, he saw what might have been a kitchen. He moved over to the almost paint-free wooden porch and stepped carefully, as close to the wall as he could get. The wood creaked and groaned slightly, but not enough for most people to hear, or so he judged. Working carefully, he peered through the mullioned glass outer door and the single pane of the main door. Nothing. Empty kitchen, dirty and ill-kept like the rest of the place. A small red light glowed on the counter. Base station for a cord-free phone. Bingo. The doors were both unlocked and he opened them with truly stellar stealth and care. He glanced at Chris and gave him three quick military hand signals. Watch, listen, and cover this area. He wanted his kid sharp while he was in the house. Chris made a clear, okay, I understand signal back. Then there was nothing for it but to get on with it. The kitchen floor was linoleum, old and even dirtier than the rest of the place. He moved with a deliberate, slow, step-by-step motion, pulling his foot back if he felt give in the floor or heard the slightest creak. Despite all his military training and hunting experience, it was fatherhood that had provided the skill to move without waking a sleeping baby or alert a homeowner. Five steps brought him to the counter. The base station was empty, the receiver missing in action. Frustrated, he made a slow, deliberate visual sweep of the kitchen, then the portion of the living room he could see. Nothing. Wait, what was that? A nub of something plastic was visible poking up from the recliner cushion. He leaned forward. Maybe. Six more slow steps brought him just into the living room. Enough of the plastic was now visible for him to see part of a keypad. He looked left and right, paused to listen, and, not hearing anything, stepped lightly into the room. The floor creaked, and something exploded out from under the chair. His gun was out of the holster, his left hand racking the action before he realized the furry missile that blurted by him was a cat. He froze, listening. Now would be when the monster would leap at him, at least based on the horror movies Chris was curiously okay with watching. Nothing happened. He moved forward and grabbed the phone. It hummed with a dial tone when he pressed send. Perfect. Turning it off, he retraced his steps, hyper-alert for attack, but nothing happened. The house was truly empty. An orange marmalade cat hissed at him from under the kitchen table as he stepped out onto the porch. Chris was exactly where he left him, and Alex could almost see the relief when his grandkid saw him. He clicked the safety on and holstered the Wilson as he moved to Chris's position.
Wireless. We don't have to be inside.
But we won't get more than a couple hundred feet from the house before it loses the signal, Chris said.
Let's recon the church, then we'll pull back here and make the call.
Roger that, Chris said, completely serious. They moved down the road, slipping off into the ditch on the same side as the church. Up close, the thing felt really, really wrong, and all of Alex's instincts screamed at him to get out of there. A glance at Chris showed that his grandson felt the place too, probably with more detail than Alex ever would, but his expression was locked down and determined. A soldier's face. The building loomed closer and Alex became aware of voices. Chanting voices. He signaled Chris to split left and that he would take the right. Rally at the back. Chris nodded, disappearing into the moonlit shadows. Light flickered in both the regular windows and the stained glass windows, obviously flame, either candle or torch. Chris's drawing had both in it. A chill shivered up Alex's spine. His grandson was now suddenly getting visions of demons, and all evidence pointed to them being real. The voices inside got louder near the back, about where he judged that the original sanctuary would be. No one was outside. The building was small, and it took just a few minutes to reconnoiter his side of it. He found Chris waiting at the back.
Nothing,
Chris whispered.
Me either. Total absence of security on this operation,
Alex whispered back. Chris held up a hand and waved it about, eyebrows raised. Good point. They were deep in the Adirondacks on a very low-volume road in a nowhere hamlet in the dark of night.
I did peek through a window. I saw two men tied up, but couldn't see their faces. Something like 10 or 12 people, wearing robes, like the vision, Chris said.
Let's make the call.
Chris nodded but pointed up at the rising moon. His point was clear. The clock ticked onward. They scooted back down the road till the handheld receiver picked up the base station, then Alex called his ranger contact.
What do you mean? You asked for help and we helped. They're tied up in some weird occult ritual.
Chris heard his grandfather say,
What did you expect? You know what we do, right? No, no, beyond search and rescue. The other thing.
A pause to listen.
Yes, that. Why? Because you said you got a creepy vibe, that's why. Your vibe was right.
Another pause.
As long as we can, but if we think things are going pear-shaped, we'll have to act. Right, then hurry up and get here.
Alex hung up and just looked at the phone for a moment. Didn't believe you? Chris asked.
Actually, I think he did. He just didn't want to believe.
How many cops and rangers and stuff know about me? Chris asked, shifting side to side on his feet.
Enough. Cops see things. They're trained to only report information that is evidential and verifiable, but they still see a lot of really weird stuff, and they talk to each other, so it might seem odd to you that the people you would least expect to believe sometimes do. Not all of them, but enough, Alex said. Now let's get eyes on the situation and observe. No action unless we have to. Sean is on his way and is calling one of the state troopers who covers this area. We should hold on till then.
Okay. But I don't think there's a lot more time left till this all goes down, Chris said, looking up at the height of the moon. They moved stealthily around to the window that Chris had used earlier. It was next to a side door near the back of the church. Alex carefully tested the knob to see if they could get in if they had to. It turned smoothly and the door wasn't bolted. Through the window he could see two figures tied back to back, lying on the plankwood floor in front of the altar. Figures in brown and black robes, which mostly looked like old blankets, stood chanting across from a lone figure whose robe seemed more legitimate. That one stood, arms tucked into sleeves, head bowed as if in prayer.
What do you think? Alex asked.
The single figure is a Hellborn. The rest are just twisted people.
Hellborn being a demon that's taken over a human? Alex whispered back. Like the one?
A demon who has pushed out the human completely. Like a hermit crab taking over another one's shell. Like the one from that night.
How do you know? Alex asked.
He didn't disbelieve Chris, but he was endlessly curious.
I can literally feel him, like his presence is pressing on a membrane around my mind. Like before. Can he feel you?
I don't think so. That's why I survived the attack. I think your fetish keeps you hidden too, Chris said.
Is it the same one, from that night?
I don't think so, but I remember that it was faster and stronger than Dad or Marcus.
Which means faster and stronger than you,
Alex said, worry rising.
Yes, but this is what you've been training me for.
If I can get hands on him, he's mine.
I think it's too soon, Alex said, and you don't know if you can actually do anything.
But here's the thing, Gramps. I do. I absolutely know that if I get hands on him, he's mine.
Chris said with a surety that Alex had never heard before. The chanting rose to a crescendo, then suddenly stopped.
It's starting, Chris said, moving toward the door. Wait, let me look first, Alex said, leaning back up to the window for a peek.
A rope was now over the exposed rafter beams of the cathedral ceiling, one end tied to the fisherman, the other being dragged up by four big men. The leader had pulled his hands apart and out of his sleeves. A massive black blade with twisting shapes carved on it was in his left hand.
It's happening, Alex said, moving in front of Chris and pulling his .45.
The safety snicked off as his left hand twisted the knob, Chris close behind him. He rushed through as the door opened, bringing his pistol up, front sight covering the knife-wielding Hellborn. As he felt Chris push through behind him, he caught motion out of the right corner of his eyes. A man with an axe was rushing at him, but the four rope pullers were in the way. The gun tracked to the new thread and fired twice, almost on its own. The axeman fell forward, blood spraying out his back. Then all of Alex's muscles locked up tight.
What have we got?
The Hellborn started to say but stopped as Chris moved into position in front of his grandfather, his left hand reaching back to touch Alex's own left arm. The paralysis disappeared, and Alex swung his sights back onto the Hellborn while trying to keep one eye on the thing's disciples. The Hellborn was frozen, eyes wide as it took in Chris. Then it smiled an inhuman smile, somehow stretching the mouth of the body it wore in a completely wrong attempt at a grin.
Unexpected, it said.
Then it brought the knife around in a blur of motion.
Shoot it, Chris said, his tone absolutely certain.
The gun seemed to go off on its own, but the Hellborn wasn't there when the bullet passed through the spot it had occupied. The thing was really fast, shifting to his left in an eye blink. He missed with his second shot as it moved left again. But Alex Gordon had seen a lot of combat and had fired thousands of rounds from guns just like this one at all kinds of targets, living or not. He twitched the barrel toward the Hellborn, then brought it back a half inch before firing. The thing had watched his gun barrel and flickered to his right, but the half inch back was just right, and this time, bullet met demon. Just barely. It hit the monster's left arm, the big bullet flinging the arm back, the knife flying away. It immediately twisted back toward his left, but this time Chris hit it, having started his rush while the knife was still moving. Its good right arm swung up, fast and powerful, but his grandson was already inside the arc of the swing. Inside of a fist, it was the inside of the elbow that hit the teen, the power enough to knock him about, but his own arm had time to get hooked under the Hellborn's right one, and his other arm pulled down on the wounded limb. Alex knew what would happen next. He'd seen it 100 times. Sure enough, Chris's hip tucked into the demon's midsection and the boy twisted up, over and down, executing a judo hip toss that, if not picture perfect, was still extremely fast and effective. The demon landed on its head and shoulders, already squirming to get free, but Chris must have begun his thing, the thing he called pushing power, because the Hellborn body went rigid, back arched up. Chris had control of the good right arm and had the joint locked with the palm of his left hand on it, his full body weight holding the demon down. Alex noticed that his grandson's eyes were closed.
Black stuff began to bubble up out of the actual skin of the elbow, collecting and pooling around Chris's left hand, moving about like it had a life of its own. The boy suddenly pulled away and stood up, the body slumping lifeless to the floor. Left hand encased in viscous, oily black crud, he lifted that arm and something like the mother of all chimes sounded, a single clear note that brought a fleeting, perfect feeling that was all right. The rope slithered over the beam as the four men holding it let go, faces stunned. The space above their heads was suddenly filled with a presence, a smoky, flapping, flying presence as big as a couch. Talons as long as a butter knife clutched Chris's upraised hand, and the awesome flying thing pulled up and away. The black, squirming putrescence was now clutched in the talons of the bird's left foot, and the big yellow beak lifted and screamed a victorious cry. The air above them collapsed, and the smoky bird was gone. The robed disciples were looking like they had all been poleaxed, eyes unfocused as Alex moved his pistol barrel to cover them, his own gaze darting to Chris to make sure he was all right. The kid looked tired but elated at the same time. He gave Alex a smile, then turned his attention to the bound men. He reached to the small of his back, under his hooded sweatshirt, and pulled out a short, viciously sharp blade from a horizontal sheath. Len's influence. The old Marine was usually covered in knives, and that small of the back thing was his signature. The blade made short work of the fisherman's bonds, and Chris got them away from the residence and sitting up. Rough boots sounded on the wooden steps outside, and suddenly a dark green uniformed figure with a pump shotgun rushed in the open door.
"Glad you made it," Alex said.
Ranger Sears looked around the room, eyes taking in the missing fisherman, the empty body, the wounded axeman, and the robed figures. His gaze lingered for a moment on the purple-eyed teen, then he turned to Alex with raised eyebrows. It took longer to tell the tale than it did to actually live it. 40 minutes later, Sean was satisfied, although the troopers and Warren County Sheriff's deputies were still processing the scene.
"Kid's pretty special, huh?"
Sean asked, both of them looking at his grandson who sat in Alex's truck.
"That doesn't begin to cover it, Sean. Not even close."
"What's he doing anyway?" Ranger Sears asked.
"I suspect he's studying. Got a Spanish quiz tomorrow. In like 9 hours. And he's not great at it."
The veteran forest ranger turned to Alex, expression incredulous.
"He's pretty tickled, though. That thing in there, it was like the one that killed my son, daughter-in-law, and my other grandson. And a 15-year-old boy just took it down and sent it back to hell. If I hadn't felt that tone or heard that thing cry out in victory, I'd be thinking about wrestling you into a funny white jacket with no cuffs," Ranger Sears said. "Glad you and Trooper Moussaw were handy when it happened then," Alex said. "But you're the one who said this place gave you the heebie-jeebies."
The door of the pickup opened and both men looked up to see Chris getting out.
"Ah, Ranger Sears, I almost forgot. This is for you,"
the boy said, pulling a black cord and small, blue, dog-like figure from around his neck. The ranger could see another necklace still there, a feather and arrowhead, but then the hoodie swallowed it back up.
"What's this?" Sears asked.
"I try to have extras on me when we do an exorcism. Afterward, we've found they act like repellent. It'll protect you,"
Chris said unsurely, glancing at his grandfather. Alex fished his own lion figurine out from under his shirt.
"That's a coyote. Zuni carved," Chris said.
The ranger looked up at the boy, eyes surprised all over again.
"That's kinda odd. I had a coyote as a kid. Was hit by a truck and I helped the lady who rehabilitated it. Always had a soft spot for them since," Sears said.
"Funny, huh?" Alex asked with a grin.
Sears' look of disbelief changed to a grimace, and he flicked a middle finger at the now chuckling Alex.
"You two need to hit the road. Someone's got a test tomorrow."
Chris looked chagrined.
Can't I stay home?"
"What would your grandmother have said to that?"
The teen didn't answer. Instead, he just sighed and turned to go.
"Chris?"
Ranger Sears asked. When the boy turned back, he found a big, meaty hand held out. He grinned and shook it, then trudged back to the truck.
Let me know if you ever, ever need help of any kind for that one, Sears said.
Oh, don't worry. I'll call in every chip, favor, and debt if I ever need to.
Good. Now get out of here. We got this. 5 minutes later, they were pulling out onto the road they'd arrived on.
Gramps?